Pornography has existed in various forms for probably most of human history, but regular people feeling compelled to share nude selfies on demand or unsolicited, sometimes before they've met in person, that hasn't always been a thing. It's new for megachurch preachers to brag from the pulpit about their hot wives. Pole dancing classes for fitness, also new. The message some people take away from all this is that young women in particular have an obligation to package themselves like porn stars. And they've been told that these performances of their sexuality are all about feminist empowerment. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Bernadette Barton is professor of sociology and gender studies at Morehead State University. She worries that sex-positive feminism has been used as a kind of Orwellian doublespeak to distract women from the ways culture now expects them to actively contribute to their own objectification. Her book about this is called The Pornification of America: How Raunch Culture is Ruining Our Society. Bernadette, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
How do you define what you call raunch culture?
Well, you did a really good job summing it up there. Raunch culture, the pornification of culture, is basically a cultural phenomenon in which elements of the sex industry have filtered into mainstream culture. So you see things like women wearing stripper heels and taking pole dancing classes for exercise and getting Brazilian waxes and feeling this compulsory quality of representing themselves as hot and sexy like a stripper or a porn star.
Why doesn't it treat men's and women's sexuality in the same ways?
Well, the short answer is patriarchy. So we still live in a patriarchal culture, and one could say even that the evidence of raunch culture is patriarchy reinventing itself for the 21st century. So men have more power in our society, and women are still trying to please men in some ways.
Okay, so you note human societies have probably always placed value on youth and beauty, but that the idea that women should make themselves sexy for men is only about a century old. What did the shift from courtship to dating have to do with that?
Oh, that's a really interesting historical note. And I got this from Lisa Wade's work, sociologist Lisa Wade. So what happened in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, was that courtship changed from being a phenomenon in which men would seek out women in their homes under the chaperonage of their mothers or families. And in that situation, there was no money exchanged. But around the 1920s, dating became a phenomenon. And when dating happened, men were expected to pay. So what women traded for this companionship, for their companionship being paid for, was making themselves look more sexy. So their sex appeal became part of the equation in dating.
So when and where did you start to notice the influence of pornography creeping into places that ostensibly should have very little to do with sex?
Well, I am a women and gender studies professor, and I have been teaching gender studies since 1995. And I am also a scholar of the sex industry. So I wrote my dissertation on exotic dancers. I've written two books on exotic dancers. So I'm very attuned to the sex industry and stripper culture and what is representative of strippers. So it was around 2002, 2003 that I really started noticing this abundance of stripper-esque paraphernalia and clothing in stores. And I remember walking by a Payless shoe store, and I'm not even sure if they exist anymore, and seeing rows and rows of stiletto heels, thinking, what the heck is happening here? So that's about when I noticed it. When I was researching the pornification of America, I dated it to around the mid-90s. And I chose that moment because that's when many of us began using the internet regularly. And so that's when internet porn began to have more of an impact on mainstream culture. So what's happening is the norms and mores of internet porn are slowly filtering and creeping into mainstream cultural norms.
So that by 2016, you have an ad for a sandwich that sounds like this.
It's a bacon lover's fantasy.
We have enough to threesome. Menage a trois. Menage a trois. Menage a trois. Menage a trois.
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. But come on, it's called the Bacon Three-Way Burger. What'd you expect?
The Bacon Three-Way Burger with 100% Black Angus beef, only at Carl's Jr. and Hardee's.
I've never been so glad to be someone who doesn't eat beef. I mean, and did people object to that ad when it was everywhere briefly?
Well, actually, I would say most people just slowly became so acculturated to it, they stopped perceiving it. And so I argue in my book that ranch culture suffers from a condition of inarticulation, that we struggle to perceive it because it has become culture, especially for young people. But I would say that the people who took offense to that at the time were mostly going to be Christian conservatives.
So does the offense taken by Christian conservatives cause everybody else to say, oh, why can't you just take a joke?
Yes. And also, aren't you uptight? And it creates this false binary where you are either conservative and against it, or you're liberal and for it. And the nuance and the gray and the sexism basically just gets lost in that, you know, cut and dry black and white debate.
So it's obvious advertisers use hyper-sexualized messaging to get our attention. Do you happen to know if it actually works to sell stuff?
Well, you know, that's a good question. That's an advertising question. I would say yes, it does work. I mean, we've been trained. Our brains have been trained over you know, 200,000 years to respond to the new and the edgy. And especially men's brains are attuned to new images of sexualized women. So I would say to some degree it's worked, but I think what's happened is that advertisers are continually seeking a new edge to keep that attention. And so that's why it's become more and more pornified over time.
Okay, so raunch culture goes beyond simply the media sexualizing women. It also has unique ways of kind of demanding that women participate in this themselves. How does that work?
Okay, so not only are women being told that you have to look sexy, they're being told that you have to, you know, model the male gaze on your own body. So you see that through sexy selfies. So social media is this other brand new, well, I mean, it's not brand new, it's been around for a few years, but in the, you know, scope of human history, it's brand new. And so social media keeps pushing that envelope there with socializing women to present themselves in sexy ways in order to get chili peppers and likes and lots of flattering comments, so that dopamine buzz is connected to presenting oneself in a sexy way, as well as, of course, just getting attention.
And when you look at this through your lens, you realize that what this is really doing is manipulating women into performing free sex work, right? They're not getting paid to post these images. They're packaging themselves and performing for the pleasure of men.
Yes, and that's what sex workers have done, and they usually get paid. So I feel like raunch culture is a big patriarchal con, you know, encouraging, manipulating women into presenting themselves as sexy to men all the time in this really exhausting and destructive way.
When we have conversations like this on the show, we inevitably hear from a couple of people who say, hold on, I like doing this. It's my choice. And therefore, I'm liberated enough to behave in these ways.
Yes. And I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that I have encountered that argument many times in many different environments. And I usually respond by saying, great, good for you. And kind of in a nice way, but it's not really about you. It's about the culture. It's about more than you. So I hope you can follow your own narrative, but also be attentive to the ways in which the culture shapes us and be aware of the experience of the most vulnerable. So, you know, maybe you're 35 and really developed in your sexuality and know what you like. Do you want the same messages that you received to be given to the 14-year-old girl who's still figuring out her body and who she is? And then I also say, you know, pay attention to when you're following your own narrative and be aware of your own inner guidance, because the tricky thing with raunch culture is you can feel empowered because that's what it tells you feel. It says, oh, women, aren't you lucky? You get to dress up in these stripper heels and do a lap dance for me, and you're empowered, and, you know, isn't it great? And, you know, and it can be fun to do that. I'm not saying that's bad or wrong, but that narrative can change in a heartbeat if you're doing that and all of a sudden some random guy calls you a really nasty name. That feeling of power and pleasure can transform instantly into something really yucky. So just a few thoughts.
Bernadette, why are women of color particularly vulnerable to hypersexualization in raunch culture?
That's a wonderful question. Okay, so that gets at the intersection of patriarchy and racism. So if we're looking at the experiences of African-American women in our society, you know, they, you know, experience hypersexualization now, dating all the way back to the antebellum South when Black people were enslaved. And white slave owners justified the legal rape of Black women by constructing them as hypersexualized and animalistic. And this set of ideas, this set of tropes hasn't changed all that much since, you know, 1820, for example. So that's one example.
On the other hand, slut stigma actually causes some women of color to feel the need to police their own expressions of sexuality to a greater extent than their white peers.
This is true. So any minority group struggles with the politics of respectability and wants to present, not, of course, not every single person, but there's a sense within the group that we should be presenting ourselves in an exceptional way so that we can't be critiqued by the majority group. So for women of color, that means that there's an added pressure not to be seen as slutty, not to have the freedom to be seen as slutty compared to white women, because that adds to the racist burden.
Okay. And does raunch culture have a different effect on heterosexual people and relationships than queer people and relationships?
Okay. So the answer to that is yes and no. So certain groups can opt out of raunch culture to some degree better than other groups. So for example, older people, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, they're going to have less engagement with raunch culture because they grew up before it happened. They probably aren't on social media as much. Maybe they don't go to the mall, for example. And I would say older lesbians especially can kind of opt out of raunch culture because it is, you know, a set of values organized around what heterosexual men like. On the other hand, though, young women, young queer women are on social media and they do feel the pressure. I spoke to some that talked about it for the book. They feel like they should look good. That themselves and their girlfriends should look a certain way and they should be sexy in a certain way. And they feel inadequate to the degree that they don't match some of those raunch culture norms. The situation with gay men is kind of its own story. And it has its own issues, but it's a has a different dynamic than that you'd see in heterosexual culture.
Can you explain what it means to be sex positive in a feminist context to start?
Okay, good. So to be sex positive means to encourage consent, to support mutual pleasure, to fight for good sexual education, to make sure everyone has access to birth control, so that there is, in fact, reproductive justice, that there's a spectrum of bodies that are perceived and experienced as desirable, and you can have sex without being married. Those are a few dimensions of sex positivity within feminism.
Why is it a mistake to equate raunch culture with sex positivity? If you can have sex outside of marriage and not feel guilty about it, why doesn't raunch culture fit neatly into that?
Because raunch culture is not actually interested in sex. I know that's like super strange to say, but raunch culture is interested in the appearance of sex, not the actual juicy, you know, bodies colliding experience of it. So raunch culture is sex negative because it's formulaic and heteronormative and puts forth one particular kind of body. Two, it focuses on appearance. So what matters is what you look like, not what you actually feel. And three, because it enables rape culture.
Hmm. Talk about that relationship between raunch culture and rape culture.
Okay, so rape culture is a culture that condones, minimizes, and trivializes rape. So raunch culture, by encouraging a group of people, women, to constantly put themselves out there as sexy, while doing nothing to get rid of rape myths that teach us to blame the victim for the sexual assaults they endure, goes, you know, hand in hand with rape culture. So raunch culture leads to rape culture, and then rape culture reinforces raunch culture.
Okay, because rape culture, among the very destructive things it does, is blame the victim when she has chosen to present herself in a way that appears sexy to men.
Right. So if you're wearing that tight little skirt, obviously you were asking for it. So even though the entire culture is telling women you're supposed to be wearing a little tight skirt all the time, that doesn't absolve you of the blame if you're sexually victimized while you're wearing a tight little skirt.
I want to pause here to note, as you do in the book, that there is egalitarian pornography in the world, but that is not the kind of pornography that informs raunch culture. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yes, there is. There's feminist pornography out there. The problem is you have to know about it to search for it. So it's not the kind of thing you're going to come across on just a general Google search for a certain kind of porn.
So, like when kids are being exposed for the first time, pardon the pun, and don't have access to a credit card, can't get behind a paywall, they're likely to see the raunchiest stuff there is.
Oh, yeah. All the free stuff is gonzo porn, and it is wall-to-wall sex scenes that are extremely sexist, usually.
So how has the internet been instrumental in growing raunch culture to the extent that you say raunch culture is culture for Americans in their 20s today?
Yes. Well, I connect the internet to pornography technologies. So would you like me to walk you through those different technologies?
Sure.
And draw those linkages? Okay. So as you said at the opening intro to the show, you know, pornography has been around forever. So if we think about the technology of porn, just going back 100, 150 years ago, it was photographs or drawings and then photographs. And then there were silent films. And then there were films that were shown in places like XXX theaters. And then there was the VHS technology, which was a huge game changer for pornography, because then people could order pornography they could watch it in the privacy of their own homes. Whereas you think about it, if you go to an XXX theater, you're venturing out into the world, you're being around other people, you know, you could be seen. Okay, so the VHS and then the DVD, which, you know, had kind of director cut discussions and, you know, interviews with the actors. And then finally to the internet, and first the dial-up, and then, rapid internet and tube technology. So each of these iterations of technology enabled people to see porn more easily, to see more porn, to see it more cheaply, to see it more conveniently, to see it on all kinds of devices. So now they don't only have to watch it on the family television, they can watch it on their computer, and then they can watch it on their tablet, and then they can watch it on their mobile phone. So people can watch pornography literally anywhere at any time now.
One of your interview subjects, I think a young woman, said almost all the women she knew watch porn, and certainly all the men do. And I think people like pornography, but is there reason to think people are watching so much pornography because other people are watching so much pornography?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I think there's probably some peer pressure effect, but pornography is something that you watch alone. So I wouldn't, not entirely.
To what extent, Bernadette, has pornography become de facto sex education for young people in this country?
Ugh, yeah, that's a depressing topic. So for the most part, it is sex ed, especially in the South, in the Bible Belt, where most middle schools and high schools do not offer any sex ed beyond abstinence-only kinds of curriculum, in which they scare young people and tell them that if they have sex, they're going to get an STD and die. So the sex ed in the South is really, really bad. It might be better in other parts of the country, but certainly young people, probably almost nowhere in the U.S., are getting the kind of high quality sex education that involves lots and lots of conversations about sex with lots of people, you know, not just even one course. I mean, young people deserve to be able to talk to their parents and their teachers and, you know, older peers and their aunts and uncles and their youth leaders and their, they should be talking to everybody openly about sex and what it means and how to enjoy it and what feels good and what works and what doesn't work. And that just doesn't happen.
So if the only way we allow them to sort of, I guess, satisfy their curiosity about what sex is through pornography, that's where they'll go for it.
Right. And they're going to see sex acts that are very violent in some cases and abusive and not typical kinds of sex that people often have.
What is bro privilege?
Bro privilege is a concept that I developed that is related to a theory called androsexism, which is an evolution or a devolution from traditional forms of sexism, in which, you know, women were secondary to men. In androsexism, women have the opportunity to be like men, to be like a guy, like a dude, like a bro, and momentarily receive bro privilege. So she can be hanging out with some guys and playing video games, and, you know, they'll talk about how hot some girl is, and she can be like, oh yeah, she's so hot, I'd do her too. And then they high five her, and then she's getting bro privilege. She gets to be in these male-centered environments as long as she, you know, obeys the rules of toxic masculinity.
Okay, so in other words, she's denied that privilege if she says, guys, I don't want to be around when you're talking about these things, or I don't want to be around people who talk about these things.
Yes, exactly so.
Bernadette, certainly there are some people, you know, in their 20s and teens who choose not to be part of this. Where does this leave them in terms of even being able to be sort of part of the dating pool?
Well, some feminists say that, you know, it's hard in raunch culture that either you're part of the culture or you're invisible. And it's really hard for adolescents in particular to, you know, be in this invisible space. But I really admire the young people that are saying, you know, it's okay for me to be me, and try to step away from it. So what is it like for them to step, you know, to stop social media, to do social media fasts? I think it's hard, but I think it's positive, and I certainly support them.
You did have a young woman in one of your classes who was like an honors student and a feminist, and she said it had never occurred to her that you could tell men no.
Yes, that was a really troubling moment. That was actually one of the moments that made me decide to write this book, because I just felt like our culture was failing young people so profoundly. This was a gender and women's studies student who was in my sex industry class. And she was just like, she was talking about a hookup and about a bad experience the next morning. And it was only at that moment that she realized that had been an assault. And I thought, how could that be? This is a women's studies student. You know, why didn't she know this 5 years ago? So that was one of my reasons I wanted to write this book.
Have you seen a reassessment, Bernadette, among sex-positive feminists of how that concept is communicated?
You know, I haven't yet, although I hope to. The language of sex positivity just basically being co-opted by patriarchy to be used in these ways that constrain and trap women. And I think that feminists who try to talk about sex positivity in a different way, like I'm doing here, don't often get the attention, mainstream attention. And so they don't have many opportunities to express these ideas to a big enough audience.
We have an email here from Tanya who asks, if pornography is considered somewhat normal, how do you address it with young people now that it is so much more invasive, now that it's everywhere?
Oh, I don't have kids, but I do say, I do have some thoughts, which is that I think it's really important to talk about it. I think not talking about sex with your kids because it makes you uncomfortable, just leaves them vulnerable to all kinds of bad stuff. And if you don't feel comfortable, have someone else do it, or at least find out what's going on with the way they talk about it so they're not getting more weirdness in this conversation. But I really love the metaphor that I read in a book, and oh, the author is escaping my name right now. It'll come to me. But she compared, when she was talking to pornography with her son, she compared looking at pornography on a screen, she compared that to sniffing canned mountain air, as opposed, like air freshener, as opposed to actually being on a mountain. And I thought that was just a beautiful way to tell a young person that what you're seeing is so small and so narrow and so unrealistic as to be, I don't know, just make you feel queasy if you spell like canned air. Just that there's such a difference between real sex and pornography that you want to be, finding out about your own sexuality and experiencing it on the mountain, not with the canned air.
If, as you say, raunch culture is culture for many 20-somethings today, is there reason to hope they will outgrow it?
I think there is. I think there is reason. And I would say it's not just for the 20-year-olds, but also for the 30-year-olds, because that millennials are suffering from raunch culture too. Yes, I think that the more people see, if you can see raunch culture, you can, like, if you can actually name it and see it, there's a power in that, because then you can make some choices. Because the raunch culture is constantly telling you a certain set of things. And until you realize that you're being fed those messages, it's hard to make other decisions. So seeing it, naming it, choosing your own path, I also think that people just can grow out of it a little bit by really falling in love and really having good sex and really figuring out who they are. And also, one other group of people that isn't talked about enough are folks that maybe don't even want to have sex. I mean, there are folks that identify as asexual, but there's also folks that maybe aren't even interested in sex or in enjoying long pauses from sex. So the idea that we always have to be compulsorily engaged in sex is simply problematic as well.
Do we have like a moral obligation to call people out for participating in this in our presence?
Well, I hesitate to tell people what they should do with other people because that's so context dependent. And if you've ever been in a situation where you're, faced with that, sometimes it's going to be very effective, and sometimes you're just going to end up in a big fight and you'll be really drained and nothing good will come of it. So, yes, I say please speak up if you can, but I don't want to encourage people to get into draining and difficult fights that are only going to make them feel bad.
Bernadette Barton is professor of sociology and gender studies at Morehead State University. Her book is The Pornification of America: How Raunch Culture is Ruining Our Society. Bernadette, this has been really interesting. Thanks for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris. It's been a lot of fun.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.